Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
On this week's edition of Latin Waves, host Sylvia Richardson has an extended interview with Jasmine Ristoff, author of Blood and Capital, The Paramilitarization of Colombia. Ristoff demonstrates how violence by state forces, paramilitary groups, and organized crime are instrumental to the process of capital accumulation by local elite and to the exercise of political power by foreign corporations. She addresses issues of forced displacement, concentrations of land ownership, growth in urban and rural poverty, and human rights violations. Ristoff also examines the excessive use of force at the recent G20 summit in Toronto and sends a warning to Canadians to pay attention to what's happening in Colombia, as Canada seems to be using some similar tactics. Stay tuned.
Someone who's written extensively on the way we are represented and our voices are misrepresented through actions of aggression and war is Jasmine Ristoff. Her book, Blood and Capital, The Paramilitarization of Colombia, looks at the complexities, the dynamics and contradictions of present-day and armed conflict in Colombia. She conducts an in-depth inquiry into the restructuring of the state's coercive apparatus and the phenomenon of paramilitarism by looking at its military, political, and legal dimensions. Jasmine Ristoff is a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of York, and she is our guest this morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Sylvia. Thank you for having me on your program.
Thank you. Now, in your book, you look particularly at paramilitarism as one of the constructs, as one of the structures that fathers a system of inequality. Paint a picture for us. How is this system organized in Colombia, and what role does the paramilitarism play in maintaining a system of inequality and continued displacement of the poor and the indigenous in that region?
You have to first of all remember that Colombia is a very unequal country in terms of wealth and land distribution. It's the second most unequal country after Brazil. And so it has been that way throughout its history since colonial time until present. And always there have been different ways in which those who have the economic power have managed to secure political power, the objective of which is to maintain their economic status and to suppress those who try to challenge the power, those who ask for redistribution, those who want to have self-sufficient livelihoods, right? So we're talking about the poor, the indigenous, the small-scale peasants, and so on. So throughout history, this constant struggle has taken different expressions. But it is, in essence, the same struggle. And actually, once I presented at a conference and I was confronted by the chair who made a comment and said, oh, come on, so you're saying it's the same old thing, the rich against the poor. This is no longer truth. And actually, it is true. It is what has been continuing. And this struggle actually exists everywhere throughout the capitalist world, but it's expressed in different ways because of the local, you know, culture, history, demography, environment, and so on. All of these factors play a role, but it is everywhere. So in Colombia, the phenomenon of paramilitarism was born precisely in this context, in a context where violence is used by those who have power in order to advance their economic interests, in order to gain more wealth, and in order to repress those who are trying to challenge them, those who feel that this political economic order is unjust. So I'm not saying that violence is not also used by other groups of people, other social sectors for different purposes. But what I'm particularly focusing on is on the violence used by the dominant sectors of society with the complicity and support of the state's coercive apparatus. So this is the context in which paramilitarism was born. It came about, or it evolved, by passing through different stages, taking on different expressions, but yet in essence its objectives were always the same. One moment of its inception can be located in the 1960s, when first it was the Colombian administration with the help of the U.S. that created these groups, and then in the 1980s when it was local elites in different parts of the country that started to create these groups, but the state supported these initiatives. So that's what paramilitarism is. And of course, paramilitarism, or in other words, the use of violence for purposes of capital accumulation, has been a crucial mechanism in the implementation of the neoliberal agenda. Basically, there are very clear links between paramilitarism and neoliberalism. Paramilitarism helps to implement neoliberal policies, or it helps to make possible the engagement in activities that are promoted by the neoliberal politicians. So, first of all, the case of resource extraction by foreign companies, right? If you want to have foreign companies extracting resources, you have to make sure that these lands are clear of any population and are made available for the foreign companies to engage in that. So that displacement, that forcible removal of people from their land, has been, for the most part, accomplished by paramilitary activities. But later you don't hear that in the news. In the news you would hear that people were displaced in Colombia because of the armed conflict, because of the violence. But in reality, there is violence, there is armed conflict, so that there can be displacement. It's a very important, tricky moment in the logic there, right? Mm-hmm. Because mostly people think, okay, yeah, there is displacement, and they don't attribute it to any particular social agent. They just attribute it to an anonymous entity called the armed conflict. In a way, it's without any identity, armed conflict. It's an abstract thing. But in reality, there are particular individuals who are benefiting from the armed conflict, and those individuals are the local elite and foreign enterprises. So this is one component of the neoliberal agenda that has been for a while implemented in Colombia, which is foreign investment, also privatization. The other component is the export-oriented agriculture, to make land available for agribusinesses, such as the African oil palm growers. Again, people have been forcibly displaced from their land. That's a clear example in the department of Chocó, where territories that belonged to Afro-Colombian communities, lands over which they had communal rights, have been taken over by these companies. But that was only made possible by repeated paramilitary operations of terror, where people were basically terrorized on a daily basis until they saw that it was impossible to live in their land, and they had to leave. And those who have managed to return there, they see that their lands have been now occupied by these large companies, and there is nothing to do to be done. And if they persist and they remain there and they camp near those lands and they demand on the government to do something, they have been again threatened. Some of the outstanding leaders have been assassinated. So these repeated waves of displacement are ongoing. It is not something that happens once and then it stops. They're not isolated events. They're processes that are ongoing. And the other component of the neoliberal agenda, which has to do with the privatization of public enterprises, the regulation of the labor force, which creates very unstable working conditions without benefits and so on, all of these things that have come with neoliberalism have been protested by people. People have been active in all these situations. But that's why, once again, the paramilitary comes to play a role by suppressing dissent, by suppressing people who rise because they are losing their jobs or because they're no longer going to have stable jobs. This is when intimidation and threats and assassinations and disappearances come in, and that's why Colombia continues to be one of the most dangerous places on earth to be a union leader, regardless of what we're being told by sympathizers of the Uribe regime in Colombia, who are saying that he has managed to reduce the deaths in unionists and so on.
One of the key components that you cover in your book is the role of major state institutions by right-wing armed groups, and how the connection between paramilitarism, which is supposed to be outside of the legal context, right? Mm-hmm. It's a sort of this subversive force that operates on its own. Could you talk a little bit about the connection that this have with the actual government institutions or major state institutions that not only funded but participate?
Yes, well, this is what makes the phenomenon of paramilitarism an ambiguous category to be studied. It is not well covered in the academic literature, and there are some journalistic accounts of paramilitary violence, but not in-depth analysis. And actually, this is what I'm working on right now, is to try to develop a new way to conceptualize paramilitarism in a way that will allow us to better understand the evolution of the paramilitary in Colombia from its inception until present. And so the paramilitary is something that is outside the official institutions of the state, outside of the official state structure, and yet it has penetrated that state structure. So that's what makes it very complicated to understand, and that's why it's very misunderstood, because obviously it's not the same as the state. You can say the paramilitary is the state, but yet the connections that exist are very long-lasting, they're very persistent, they're basically systemic connections. You mentioned major state institutions that have been penetrated by the paramilitary, and this is what I document in my book, is that basically the justice system with its various institutions, the courts, individuals working in those institutions such as lawyers, criminal investigators, prosecutors, and so on. Then you have the political institutions, from local mayors all the way up to the president, to Congress. You have, even in the education system, in universities, you have the penetration of paramilitary power. And then again, the economy itself, which is so penetrated by capital that has been acquired through violence, that it's no longer possible to tell here is what's legal and from here is where the illegal begins. You can no longer differentiate between legal and illegal capital because it has been fused in such a way that it's impossible to tell. So this is the magnitude of the penetration that we're talking about.
How has the war on terror and the war on drugs contributed to the naturalization of violence as a tool for the advancement of capital production?
That's a great question. Well, the war on drugs, which began officially with Plan Colombia, that came into existence in 2001. Plan Colombia was to fight the war on drugs. Then later, after September 11, the war was now called the war on terrorism. So what these labels are, they are expressions of the ideology that the state's coercive apparatus is producing. And what is this ideology aimed at? It's aimed at legitimizing these military activities. It's aimed at legitimizing the militarization of the country to justify the fact that the countryside in Colombia is militarized. There's more military presence, more military bases. Individuals are subjected to searches and detentions and raids by the military. This is what we mean by militarization, right? So it's aimed at justifying this, to show that there is an actual mission going on. What in reality these wars are, they are like a package that has the, you know, the legal component, the military component, and the ideological component. And the legal component are the actual laws that make it possible for these projects to be implemented. The military component is, you know, the funding for expanding the powers of the state forces and the police and so on. Ultimately, though, what these projects do is that they create security. Yes, they do create security, but that's security for corporations. That's security for local companies and foreign corporations. That's for whom they establish security. The war on drugs, okay, it's been clear that the war on drugs is failing. Drugs continue to be shipped out of Colombia. The growth of illegal crops has not been reduced. They just migrate to different parts of the country. The fumigation has only managed to poison people and poison their environment and lead to all kinds of health problems. So as far as the war on drugs is concerned, it's just an ideological label out there. As far as the war on terrorism is concerned, well, the only terrorists that are recognized to exist now are the guerrilla, because the paramilitary, although they were listed before as a terrorist group, never in the Colombian history was the state dedicated to persecuting the paramilitary the way in which they operated against the guerrilla. Never did this happen. And today the state says that there are no longer paramilitary groups out there. That's a very big topic, which I won't go into details now, but just to say that, yes, paramilitary groups continue to exist, contrary to what the state tells us. The only terrorist groups are the guerrilla. So, in fact, actually the Obama administration reduced funding for fumigation and the war on drugs and channeled this these funds into counterinsurgency operations in Colombia. So even with the signing of the agreement on military bases, you can see that more and more attention now is placed on counterinsurgency. So in other words, it's becoming even more obvious. They're no longer even trying to hide it, that anti-terrorism measures are taken and are actually counterinsurgency measures. And at the same time, they accomplish two goals, right? One is to combat the guerrilla, and the other is to create security and stability for foreign capital. And these were the two main tenets of the Uribe administration, and they continue to be now the two main tenets of the Santos administration, because Santos is just a continuation of Uribism, right? And those two tenets are to provide investors confidence, which is accomplished through ensuring security. And security, this mission of security, justifies any kinds of human rights violations and deaths of civilians and human suffering. All of these are justified in the name of this mission of establishing security. And the other basic objective of the state is to combat the guerrilla. So these are the two major objectives which they are accomplishing by this increased militarization and by having these military projects under the names of war on terror, war on the insurgency, war on drugs.
Very important points you touched on is the role of militarism and the increasing military presence of U.S. bases in Colombia, and how this is directly tied to providing security for foreign capital. Can you talk a little bit about the incredible threat this poses to the changes that are taking place in South America, particularly Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador?
Just to give you a little bit of background, the military bases agreement is a 10-year renewable military agreement which Colombia and the U.S. signed in October of last year. And this gives the U.S. forces access to 7 military bases in the country. When we say access, it means to be able to use these bases for operations, logistics, training, and to have free movement among them. we're talking about two air bases, two naval bases, three army bases, in addition to the existing two military bases, as well as all the international civilian airports. All of these can be used by the U.S. Army, the Air Force, and the Marines. The official reasons that are given by the U.S. government and the Colombia government is that these bases are there to fight the narco-terrorists. And according to Colombia, having these bases there is the only way to protect itself from aggressive neighbors, which they're referring to Venezuela. And some of the things to keep in mind here is that there are internal implications and there are also external geopolitical implications. But let me just, if I have time, just mention a few things about the internal implications. One very important thing is that there is no limit on the number of U.S. personnel that can be present in Colombia at any given point in time. So this means increased militarization. And increased militarization means more human rights violations, because this is what history has shown, especially keeping in mind that in the past there has been tolerance and collaboration even between paramilitary groups, Colombian military, and U.S. military personnel in Colombia. And the other thing that can also very easily lead to more human rights violations is the fact that this military personnel in Colombia has diplomatic immunity, which means that whatever violations they may carry out, they will not be held responsible for. Okay, so that's internally speaking, the impact on the local population in Colombia. If we're looking at what is the geopolitical implication of all this within the region of Latin America, well, one thing to keep in mind is that the base in Palanquero is one of the largest. $46 million actually were spent on the expansion of this base, to make it big enough to house 100 planes, to have a 10,000-foot runway that allows for three planes to take off at once, to accommodate the large C-17 planes, which are planes that can span the entire hemisphere without the need to refuel. They can go and come back, carrying large number of military personnel inside them. So all of this actually provides opportunity, in the words of the U.S. Air Force Military Construction Program, to carry out full-spectrum operations in areas where there are threats from terrorist insurgencies and anti-U.S. governments. So clearly, these bases are there to facilitate U.S. presence in the region and at any point make possible intervention to facilitate the monitoring, the intelligence gathering, but also in military intervention. And Ecuador and Venezuela have been the countries that have been most outspoken against this agreement, and also Bolivia. And these are all countries that have in some way tried to pursue more autonomy, more independence from U.S. interference in their country, so that they can build more just and equitable societies. There are clear reasons why they're worried about the U.S. military presence there, because Colombia is located in a very strategic part of South America. So it's bordering with Venezuela, it's bordering Ecuador, it's not far from Bolivia. It is also very close to the Amazon basin, which is the home of huge biodiversity, gold deposits, and other mineral deposits. So the U.S., by being there, this is basically the military measure through which is ensured that capitalist interests in the region won't be threatened by any of those other, in quotation mark, aggressive neighbors, which means neighboring countries that are not open to U.S. imperialism and that are clearly rejecting any form of interference in their own affairs.
Stay tuned for the rest of the interview with Jasmine Ristov. You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com.